Okay, so first my argument, my kind of narrative. You all know Second Life. I don't have to go into details. That, by the way, is me, Igal Udal. And that's my famous hangout over there, overlooking the sea. To the right, you have NPR, just in case you wonder what that is. Second Life, of course, has, as of today, 5.2 million registered users. If you do a little bit more of a math, it's about 300,000 real frequent users. Frequent users have exploded over the last couple of months. If you look at the graphs, frequent users usually spend about 15 hours or more a week online. Not the 20 plus hours that they used to, but still 15 plus. Use, as you know, is free, but the provider, that is Linden Lab, makes its money from leasing virtual land. Now, what is happening in Second Life, you all know that there is any kind of human interaction that we have in the real life is at least theoretically possible in the virtual domain as well, and most of it is actually done, including, of course, the area of commercial transactions. There have been 9 million commercial transactions in world in just 1 month, and about $1.8 million spent a day right now. So this would point towards a $600 to $700 million economy. Now, there's a very important difference to make between what is called conventional virtual worlds and Second Life, and this is a differentiation that will drive my argument. Conventional virtual worlds like World of Warcraft here are, and its telos, its story, are created by the provider, Microsoft, Sony Online Entertainment, you name it. There are, therefore, very artificial in-world economies, very, very artificial. And, for example, virtual goods are awarded or given to users by the provider, for example, because they solved the puzzle or sort of slayed a dragon or whatever. And then these virtual goods can then be traded back to the provider for a fixed price. So in a sense, you have a Stalinistic planned economy where you have a clear rule of what you have to do in order to get something, and the state is always buying it back for a fixed price. This is how conventional virtual worlds work for the most part in world. Not outside of the world, where you have economies. Now, contrast that to user-produced virtual worlds like Second Life, where you basically have a virtual world that initially is empty. Users can build anything that they want. They have relatively powerful tools as well as a scripting language so that they can give their virtual goods behavior. And, of course, famously, they own intellectual property rights to the virtual goods that they produce, if they produced it themselves. So, Second Life is built on the premise that these intellectual property rights can be, at least to an extent, guarded. Now, what has this done to the world? If you look at user-produced content in Second Life, by November of 2006, the last time I got stats from Corey Andreka, the chief technical officer of Second Life, there were 60 million user-produced objects in the world. So the world was relatively large already. More code has been produced for Second Life than for Linux. And if you would hire programmers and do the same amount of coding that has been done for Second Life, you'd have to hire about 10,000 full-time programmers. This is also very important because if you want to compete with Second Life on content, you would actually have to hire 10,000 full-time programmers to just keep pace. Okay. Now, Second Life has caused a lot of interesting research questions to pop up. One, of course, the most important one from my perspective, from your perspective as well, has been the, sort of the governance and virtual world. And we have seen papers by LaStoker and Hunter, Dan Hunter, on virtual property rights, on balancing rights, Jack Balkin from Yale, and on the various governance structures that can be imagined, Amy Bruckman, James Grimmelman, and others. Another line of research has looked at what are the spillovers between real world and virtual worlds. These spillover effects are relatively pervasive and relatively interesting. For example, you may know or have heard that Sony Online Entertainment was initially quite adamant at limiting the ability of users to sell or auction off virtual goods through eBay, and therefore got eBay to agree to not have auctions on virtual goods, which of course caused another auction site to come into being called ItemBay in Taiwan that basically does nothing else but sell virtual goods that eBay has refused to auction off. And that created a secondary market, very vibrant secondary market for conventional virtual world goods. You don't need this kind of market for Second Life because, in fact, for Second Life, it's just perfectly fine to trade in virtual goods. You also have lots of interesting tensions coming up from low-cost labor in China. Over 100,000 people apparently are playing virtual games these days and are in world to create stuff. There is a significant amount of outsourcing going on. There's also the question of innovation. Ed Castronovo, in his book, has talked about the ability to short-circuit the creation or the awarding of virtual goods, for example, through an automatic slaying of dragons, through a script. And then, of course, you run a lot of computers that run the script day and night, and you create, therefore, a lot of virtual goods that you own, and then you sell them off ItemBay, which basically causes inflation in the country, or it causes sort of the price, the devaluation of goods, and other users protest against that. This is basically a story of industrial innovation and industrial revolution played all over again. Now, more interesting to me are the issues of regulatory dynamics among virtual worlds. There's not just one virtual world out there, there is a number of them out there. And the question is sort of, what is the dynamic between these virtual worlds? And if you have these virtual worlds, what then is the option for real-world policymakers, real-world lawmakers, who look at this universal landscape of virtual world providers? I'd like to focus on these last two ones in the remainder of my talk. Now, first let's ask ourselves, does a virtual world provider have the mechanisms in place to govern? And that is usually, you know, you ask whether you have the mechanisms in place to set the rules and to enforce them. Now, as we know, because we all have read Larry Lessig all over, you know, again and again, we can assume that virtual world providers can set rules through software code. If they want to stop us flying Second Life, they just build it in code and we can't fly anymore. They can also, though, build it into contractual terms through the end-user license agreement and through terms of service. So they can say, look, you still can fly, but you're prohibited from flying. And if you violate these terms of service or the agreement, then I, as the provider, have the right to force you out. And how does forced exit work? Well, also through software code or through sort of taking you out of the database and making sure that you can't log on with the same credit card or whatever. So the long and short of it is that virtual world providers do have the necessary mechanisms in place to set the rules and to enforce them. Now, when we look at economics of virtual worlds, which is sort of the second part, the underpinning, the theoretical underpinning, the economics are relatively simple and straightforward. First, you try to attract capital inflow into your virtual world by attracting a lot of users who then either lease land or pay a monthly fee. That's the most important that you have to do. And then the second, less important one is to retain users,
to rationalize,
because they will contribute to the revenue stream every month. That's much easier than attracting them because of the network effects, the positive network externalities that are present. So what is there for a conventional provider strategy, right, in terms of attracting users, which is the first prong, and retaining users, which is the second prong? First, they build content, and they compete on better content, right? So if you're a large company, you can hire, or you have a well-funded company, you hire a lot of programmers to build a lot of content. And that's why if you today look at online role-playing games, it's in excess of about $30 million to produce it. Okay. Now, you can also compete on price. Okay. Sure. You can charge less than the others can. You can compete on regulatory framework, that is, you can say, look, I run my world better than anybody else does. And finally, you can compete on size. My world is bigger than yours, and therefore...
always comes down.
So once you have attracted users through a mixture of content, price, regulatory framework, and size, you then have to retain it, which is relatively easy and straightforward because of the stickiness of conventional worlds, right? You have all your social network in your conventional virtual world, and you can't take anything out. You can't take your virtual goods out. You lose everything if you leave, which basically means in sort of the real world equivalent that you are told you can leave the country, but you can't take anything with you. Now, when we go back to price, regulatory framework, and size, let me just say one more word on price, and that is, turns out that it's relatively inelastic. Demand is relatively price inelastic. It's $10, it's $15, it's $20. Whether it's $10 or $8 or $12 doesn't really matter for the user, because the investment for the user is really time rather than money. Okay. Now, compare that to user-producing virtual world strategies. Again, you have attracting users and retaining users, your two-prong strategy. Let's look at the four that I suggested: content, price, regulatory framework, and size. What you see is that if you are a user-producing virtual world like Second Life, the content is rather costless. That is, it is produced for you by your users. As long as you have lots of users, you have hopefully lots of content, 60 plus million in the case of Second Life. In that sense, you have very strong network effects for the content production usually in place. Now, at the same time, however, that comes with a weakness in the system, and the weakness is that the stickiness decreases. Stickiness decreases because by granting intellectual property rights, you also at least theoretically permit users to take their bundle and leave. And so it's easier to leave. At the same time, you know, you are basing your whole economic premise on the fact that the people stay and build content and join because of the network externalities. Now, what can real-world providers do to counter the free, costless content? Not much. They can hire more programmers or more designers, right? If you're a conventional virtual world, you are stuck in a relatively strict economic paradigm where you really need to pay for content. If you're a user-producing virtual world, your content is produced for you by and large. There is, however, so it looks like user-producing virtual worlds are the way to go. So there is a small caveat, but important caveat here, which I call the caveat of constitutionalization. The sheer fact that Second Life said you retain intellectual property rights causes a spillover of legal rules in real world, our intellectual property laws, our copyright laws, into the virtual world. You're embedding it into the virtual world. You're injecting it into the virtual world. And therefore, as a provider like Lindenlab, you are locked in. You know, what can you do once you have granted intellectual property rights to your users? You can tell them that by tomorrow, you expropriate them. You take their intellectual property rights away. What will they do? They will leave, or many of them will leave, right? So that's not what you want. So therefore, you are locked in to the promise that you made of accepting intellectual property rights that users retain. And therefore, you are locked into a real-world kind of regulatory regime. Should the U.S. change fair use, it has immediate consequences on what is possible in Second Life, regardless of whether the user in Second Life is in Shanghai in Taiwan or elsewhere. Therefore, lock-in constrains virtual worlds providers' future behavior, which is, by the way, exactly what we call, or what we assume constitutions do. They constrain future behavior of lawmakers. And real-world IP laws, therefore, facilitate this process of constitutionalization. Now, if we have constitutionalization in place, we have a new competitive landscape of attracting users and retaining users. You're not competing on provider-created content anymore because you're not creating any content yourself anymore. Price, we said, is not particularly important, a differentiator, and it doesn't provide you with a competitive enough advantage. The real important issues are regulatory framework and size. You compete on size because that means you have a lot of people who produce, and you compete perhaps on regulatory framework, that is, I can do things better than you are. My world is run better. The streets are clean kind of idea. At the same time, you have a much, much, much reduced stickiness because people retain IP rights and can take their bundle. So what does this do in terms of regulatory dynamics? And here we sort of take the theory of regulatory dynamics and apply it to Second Life, which is quite interesting because, of course, the classical response to it is, we'll have regulatory competition between virtual worlds, okay? So regulatory competition means one virtual world offers a more conducive regulatory framework than another virtual world. Now, a lot of people would immediately say regulatory competition, that means race to the bottom, right? And that means the virtual world provider wins who has the least restrictive governance regime. But that's not true. There have been, if we look at regulatory competition theory, there have been regulatory races to the top, regulatory races to the bottom, regulatory races apart. The best idea, the best way to understand it is that we will have temporary equilibria. People with particular preferences on how they want their world to be run will choose the world according to their preferences. So you'll have lots of different worlds according to the preferences. Some are really run well but have no democratic governance, like Singapore, in virtual worlds parlance. Some are run badly, but you can do everything that you want. Some may actually have incredibly strong freedom of religion rights, but perhaps much weaker rights on freedom of contract or other things, depending on the preferences of the users. So what you see is only temporary so-called Thibault equilibria, that is a balance of virtual world providers that reflect the preferences of their user base at any given moment in time. And if users of one world, you know, just come to wake up one morning or sort of be agitated about a particular problem in their virtual world, and the virtual world provider doesn't react to it, they will move to another virtual world that's more conducive and therefore upset the temporary Thibault equilibria until the equilibria is established again over the sum of all virtual worlds. Now, that's the sort of competition part. The coordination part is similarly interesting because you would imagine that there is no standardization, no coordination among virtual worlds, right? You compete to get and attract users. Why should you work with each other? And there's where John is coming in next week on April the 10th, I think. Because in fact, virtual world providers may have an interest in working with each other. Why? Virtual worlds provider really want to make it easier to join, for users to join their virtual worlds. They want to make it easy to immigrate, but make it hard to emigrate. Okay. So export should be hard, import should be easy. Now, interestingly enough, that's a collective action problem of sorts, because I need to know another virtual worlds provider's way of how data is being described in the database in order to make it easy to import. So therefore, I need to reverse engineer, I can't DMCA, but Therefore, I need to reverse engineer kind of what the other virtual world provider does. Wouldn't it be easier, therefore, to sit together with the other virtual world provider and say, why don't you let me understand how you are representing your data, and in return, I will let you have a look at my database structure, and therefore, we have import and export functionality. But this can only work if there's no free writing. That is, if it is a bidirectional process of everybody opening up their database structures to everybody else in that coordination group to see. And in fact, this is what we're seeing. When we look at Second Life, Second Life is actively working on an export functionality for intellectual property. And you would think that this is totally stupid. Business-wise, because they should make it hard for people to emigrate and easy for people to immigrate. The truth, however, is that a lot of companies are sitting on the fence and say, look, I'd love to invest in Second Life, but I will only invest it if I'm not taken hostage by you, if I'm not at your will and if I'm not dependent on your future existence. And so, therefore, Second Life has the duty almost, the economic duty, the business duty, to create an export functionality so that their future investors can take their virtual goods out of Second Life and import it into another virtual world should they want to. In fact, that is what some of the future investors desire to have in place before they invest in Second Life. Final point to make. Regulatory transplantation. What is really interesting is that people move from one virtual world to another. But by doing so, they also bring along their values and their preferences. If you have a lot of immigrants in one country from a particular other country, this target country's value set will over time change because new people come in with slightly different values. And that is very true for virtual worlds as well. So if you have a lot of World of Warcraft folks moving over to Second Life, you'll have a different world. You see this. If you talk to Second Lifers who have been in Second Life for years, they tell you their phases. The newbies come in and they have played other virtual worlds before. They have different value sets. So that's one way of regulatory transplantation, value transplantation. That, of course, changes the dynamic within a virtual world. But most importantly, regulatory transplantation also happens through import and export of virtual goods, because each and every piece of virtual property also retains some values, what can and cannot work, what does and does not function. And if you bring that into a new world, you also bring the old constraints into the new world. And that changes this target world. And so you have a dynamic of regulatory transplantation in addition to coordination and competition dynamics. So what therefore can, and that's my final point to make here in my narrative, what can real-world policymakers do? First, they can regulate the providers. They can regulate Linden Lab. And they can do that because there are bottlenecks of control. Linden Lab is a great provides a great mechanism of control because they currently have all the power of control. The problem, however, is that too much control might actually stimulate regulatory arbitrage. That is, that users may move away from one virtual world to another virtual world that isn't as controlled by the government. They might move to a different world in the United States, or they might move to a world somewhere outside of the United States where the state, the lawmaker, the national lawmaker isn't as constraining as, for example, in the United States. And therefore, revenue streams flow out into this other virtual world and have detrimental effect. John, you wanted to ask a quick question?
Well, I'll let you finish.
Okay. So that's the downside of that. The other possibility is really to constrain regulatory dynamics. That is, to prohibit, for example, users from to basically, two ways, to coordinate in the real world. That is to have an international agreement, an international covenant of how to deal with virtual worlds. Because then people can't move from one real world jurisdiction to another real world jurisdiction by, when choosing their provider, and therefore cannot pick the regulatory environment of their provider. Okay, so you can coordinate. Very unlikely to happen. Because this is all about issues of freedom of speech, of contractual freedom, of privacy, of intellectual property, forget it. The other thing is that you constrain users to switch providers, to move from one provider to the other. And you can do that either, you know, through a law that says once you've selected the virtual world provider, you can't switch away. Now, possible, not likely. Potentially more likely, you can switch providers as much as you want, but you can't switch to a provider outside of your home country. So you can switch to any U.S. provider as a U.S. citizen, but you can't switch to a Malaysian provider. But still unlikely to happen in the United States. Okay. You can't really be a politician that is advocating choice and market and then sort of prohibiting choice and market. Well, you can.
All the time. I mean, come on.
Okay.
Corrected.
Only in the rarefied worlds of academia.
Academia, you say no.
That's right. That's sorry. So, but the real problem of these two ideas to regulate is that they're based on the fact that you have a provider, that you have a unitary, single, discrete entity that you can regulate. You have a Linden Lab. You have a Sony Online Entertainment. You have a Microsoft. And that, of course, has a significant problem built into it. Because if you are clamping down on a unitary provider of a particular service that you deem is not useful in your society, you might have people who really want the service to organize themselves. Does that ring a bell? We had that before. It was called music sharing, and it's all the story about Napster. So if you clamp down on Second Life, or virtual world providers like Second Life, what you are doing is repeating the story of Napster. And what then could be coming up as a response is peer-to-peer provision of virtual worlds, which we already see. There is an open source project of a peer-to-peer provided virtual world out there that you can download and sort of join in. Hasn't gotten traction yet, but you know what? When Napster was still alive, Kasa and others didn't have traction yet. That largely depends on what real-world providers do. So therefore, two potential responses that I think are a little more helpful. One is restricting permeability. That is to make it hard for money to flow back and forth to virtual worlds and from virtual worlds. You can do that, but when you do that as a real-world lawmaker, you are reinforcing the idea that the virtual world is a separate space, because you're increasing sort of, you're decreasing permeability. You're saying this is really a separate space. Whatever you do there is fine, but you can't have spillover effects into my real world. And that's probably not what you want to do if you're a real world lawmaker, because then you are basically agreeing with Johnson and Post from 10 years ago. The other one is that as a real-world lawmaker, you may want to facilitate virtual-world self-governance. That is, you may want to move into Second Life and help the citizens to create robust and accountable governance structures, because then you have a counterpart to deal with. And that is much easier and much better than to have no counterpart to deal with. Now, that's the argument. Six quick counter-arguments. Counter-argument group one, the user production argument. You know, Maya Schumberger, it's really not clear that users will favor user-produced worlds. They may favor World of Warcraft, Sony Online Entertainment's world, because they are really nicer, while, you know, Second Life is sort of rough on the edges. That may be, but that's transitory. This is basically the argument of whether central planning or the market will win. We know where that went. We kind of can predict that. And so we know who wins in the long run. I think that's not a very valid argument. Second is the transaction cost argument. That is, transaction costs are actually significantly higher, Maya Schrimberger, than you think by moving from one world to the other. Therefore, you have higher stickiness, and therefore your whole argument blows up. Now, with respect to switching costs, there are two possible parts of switching cost. One is the social network that you lose if you move alone. Well, that depends on what your social network is and whether you can get enough of your social network to move with you. We've seen that in World of Warcraft, where entire groups of players moved away from World of Warcraft and into Second Life and rebuilt parts of World of Warcraft in Second Life and play it now in Second Life because it's just more malleable, more flexible to do it there. As long as you take a significant chunk of your social network with you and can convince them to do so, your cost is relatively low in terms of social network cost. In terms of virtual goods created, I talked already about the export functionality, and insofar as that's in place, switching costs are low. Third counter-argument, network effects argument, that is, content is king, not governance. Sure, clearly content is the most important differentiator, but that's something that providers really can't control very well in user-created worlds. The only thing that they can hope for is to have lots of people because lots of people will produce, but not necessarily. If you have just a good group of people who are producing a lot, even if you're not the virtual world with the highest number of users, you might still do relatively well. And governance might, in the longer run, play a more important role. The other part of counter-arguments is related to the governance part of my narrative. So the first one is the good governance argument. That's saying, oh, Maya Schrimberger, come on, this is sort of the stupid democracy story again. Not everybody likes democracy. And you seem to suggest that at the end, the best virtual world is the one that's the most democratic and that's what will survive. No, never said that, I hope. What I said is that there might be temporary Thibault equilibria of virtual worlds with very different preferences. In fact, I do think that we'll see virtual worlds like Singapore and virtual worlds that are much different than Singapore. Maybe we'll see a virtual world that's like Iraq today. Because there was the thrill of constant civil war. I don't know. But we see a lot of different virtual worlds emerge, I'm sure. And therefore, I don't see a convergence towards a particular model. The why care argument. That's all fun, but why should we care? This is all drivel in the worlds of bits. But not has nothing to do with feeding people or with staying alive or so forth. So why should real world lawmakers care? Well, that's a hard one. That's a harder one to answer, except that, of course, the more people spend and are immersed in virtual worlds, the more they care about what is going on. And we have a lot of things that we care about apart from and beyond surviving. And therefore, real-world lawmakers should care. In fact, they already care if you have followed the news on the IRS trying to tax profits in Second Life and so forth. And then there is the third one, third of the second set, and that's the spillover argument. And that is, isn't it much easier to target currency exchanges, that is to go on a bottleneck again, if you want to reduce the spillover? Even if you have a peer-to-peer system, you still have some. You need to have some mechanism of bringing money in and out of these worlds, and you clamp down on that because these are just credit card companies or whatever. The truth of the matter is that this is much, much harder than you might think, as the U.S. has found out in the context of gambling and betting. So quick summary, therefore. Analytically, I think virtual worlds are really fun because you can test theories of regulatory competition. Normatively, I talked about the challenges for real-world policymakers on whether and how to regulate, and I suggested that perhaps it's best for real-world lawmakers to facilitate robust self-governance structures rather than clamp down on and over-regulate virtual world providers. Now, this was my part. Now it's your part to shoot some holes into it. John.
Well, I'm not necessarily shooting holes, but I just want to build on a couple of points and get some clarification. One of the things that surprised me, and we've been looking at the whole area of interoperability, you know, of virtual worlds.
Right.
And it turns out that a lot of companies, and this includes not just the IBMs, but Nike, Reebok, Fidelity, a lot are very much concerned about interoperability and different going in and out of different virtual worlds. So this whole question of being able to take your 3D assets from one world to another world is something that is very much they want.
Yes.
And we've been working on something called Higgins, which is an open source identity, user-centric identity model that enables that. So what I'm getting at is that it seems by the market and a lot of, and for example, if you take some of these companies, say that we're more than willing to compete on our ability to be efficient within a particular world. We don't have to have this. The old stickiness model is an old business model.
Right.
And matter of fact, that we think we can make offers more efficiently in our different worlds than we can in the physical world.
Right.
And so this the divide between the virtual and the physical is being right. blended very deliberately, and companies are looking at it that right. way. So which at a very very fast rate. One of the issues that does stick out though, and you didn't mention QQ, which I think is worth mentioning, in that they're 226 million, and they have their Q coins, and it is becoming a problem. In China, in that there is a question of the government coming in and trying to regulate. There was just an article in the Wall Street Journal to
right.
that effect.
Right.
And Second Life has an issue in that a lot of people argue that the exchange is a game. It's a Ponzi scheme. There's a right. whole blog done on this, and so you're going back and forth. Is this really a Ponzi scheme? Right. And do you have the liquidity?
Right.
And there's a real failure of counterparties in that world. So you don't have a robust authentication systems. Hence, you don't know who you're dealing with. And so it's But my view is that you are going to be able to compete and differentiate on the ability to have sort of efficient transactions and trust, and that parties can go in, they know who they're dealing with, and then you're going to get market efficiency. So they sort of differentiate themselves on that basis. I think one of the challenges is this whole question of when you start creating virtual currencies that are convertible.
Hmm.
So I guess my question is. One, I think the distinction between the virtual and physical world is being really blended and will continue to be very blended, and hence what is the regulatory interface of that, particularly when you look at currencies,
okay.
and what are the jurisdictional issues you're going to have, say the U.S. versus global versus local currencies, whatever,
right.
and what might be the appropriate intervention on that if right. need be.
Right.
And the second thing is this whole role of interoperability of identity and assets that people control with there, and so that basically it's a citizen-based, user-centric model that allows you to take it with you, which seems to be supported by companies.
Hmm.
And so there's a break with the old model, saying, we capture the information, and we own it. Just saying, no, it's actually in all of our interests. And Doug can speak to this: is to break down the silos, and you can be able to
sure.
greater 360 value.
Yeah, I think, many companies around the world work on the sort of portability of identity issue. That's certainly one of the hot issues coming up.
Right.
And that will reduce the stickiness further, I am sure. More interesting to me at this point in time is the currency issue. And it's not just the currency, it's also land supply in Second
Life. Right,
well,
it's inflated, right.
For example, Linden Lab was clamping down on land supply in the late 2006, early 2007. The reason for that was quite simple. Adding land means adding servers. And they were running at some technical limits to do that fast enough. And so they couldn't add fast enough land, because they first had to change some of the plumbing of the system, because they hadn't expected to grow as quickly. And so they needed to create a structure that is more sustainable and a sort of rapid growth. That, of course, drove up land prices very, very quickly. And so people started complaining about high land prices. So then Linden Lab was under the gun to add more servers, to add more land to mitigate the problem of exploding land prices. So they have to run a relatively smart currency policy and a relatively smart land supply policy. That's one of the reasons why Corey and others at Linden Lab are working with, you know, real good economists around the world to solve these issues. Now, these issues are not particularly different from issues that you see in places like Dubai. You know, you look at Dubai and you can say, that's a pansy game as well, right? You people, a lot of people.
Ponzi. Pansy's another. Ponzi.
Sorry. That's kind of a pyramid pyramid scheme as well. You can go in there, you can invest in the country, but you can't really take it out anymore.
Right.
And there's a very, once it crashes, once the stability is gone, there's a very, very, very limited market for you to sell to. So you're basically hoping for stability and you're banking on the future. That's very true for virtual worlds as well. But the reason why I made this comparison between Dubai and the virtual worlds is because we already see this or see similar things happening in the real world, and we deal with it. We kind of do a risk assessment of sorts, and we'll deal with it. And companies that invest in places like Second Life have to basically make that assessment. And some of them say, sure, 10 million, we'll risk it, like IBM, and others will say, before we risk it, we want to have export functionality in place so that we can move. But at the end of the day, this is sort of this
so they would compete on the basis of policy in the subject. They would compete, in other words, having a highly transparent currency policy, and that was very part of a differentiator that would
part of the governance structure.
Right,
part of the governance structure. But you know, the most important thing, of course, like Dubai, is you need to have a stable society. If the people that just you know, remember the protest in Second Life sometimes back when people set themselves on fire in the welcome area so that new users would come in and see all these users setting themselves on fire.
What are others?
You know, they would log in right away. So that really drove the point home rather succinctly to Linden Lab to address the issue. So you have citizen protests that can be very efficient, right? Why? Because as a provider of virtual worlds, Linden Lab has all the interest in keeping societies relatively stable.
I was curious if you could be more specific about robust self-governance structures and whether what you're talking about here is that let's take these virtual worlds seriously and basically create the equivalent of a city council that is empowered by the government, or whether you're talking about something more like, let's give them technical assistance, you know, like the same way as we might encourage civic society, but not make it literally governance in the sense of.
You know, I think basically the answer is both. And the reason for it is that most experiments in the past that I looked at in setting up formal governance structures have failed. So my sense is not dissimilar to the real world. We're setting up formal governance structures without civil society structures to hold it have failed. It is probably suitable to invest at least a significant part of this assistance into the creation of civil society mechanisms and processes.
But then does this go back to that, one of the points that you made was why care? Or one of the criticisms of this argument is why care? I mean, are we at the point, we're having enough trouble trying to get Iraq to have a civic society and self-governance. Is there really enough concern here?
Yes, but my sense is, why care about Iraq? I mean, the, you know, look at it. There are 300,000 almost half-time users, or 150,000 if you do full-time equivalent users in Second Life, that basically have their life there. you know, in a year or so, the U.S. has about 25,000, if the plan is correct, or so, 20,000 soldiers in Iraq. Shouldn't we care more about Second Life than should we care about Iraq? I mean, that's one of the questions that we need to ask. And if you think about what impacts people's lives, I'm not so sure that that is American people's lives, that Iraq that matters that much.
Victor, I want to come at it from a different point of view and see if it connects. I got involved in Second Life in my evidence class this winter and wound up doing a mock trial of a case that arose out of Second Life that you may be familiar with, Bragg versus Linden Labs. This is a case in which a guy named Bragg had bought land in Second Life to a value of something like 3,000 real American dollars. And somewhere along the line, he figured out how the auctions for the land worked. He figured out that if he put in the right designator, he could find the auction page before Linden Labs had activated the auction. That is, they hadn't linked it to their front page, but it was up on their site. And he could activate the page and buy the land cheap. So he bought a bunch of land for $300. And at a subsequent time, Linden got suspicious of it. They initially sent him an email saying, "We're rescinding the sale." But then as they looked further, they decided this guy was malicious. And they just eliminated him. They X'd his avatar. They confiscated his $3,000 worth of land and resold it. He then proceeded to file a lawsuit in the Western District of Pennsylvania in federal court, actually originally in state court, and is removed, and it's ongoing. So we actually did a mock trial in Second Life on the issue. And the thing that was, this is what's interesting. There were two worlds. The law, in a sense, in one sense, is the law of the user agreement. The user agreement is written by the lawyer for Linden Labs. It's written so that Linden Labs can do anything it wants. The user has no rights whatsoever. Right? And then there's the perception of the citizens within Linden's world, within Second Life, who are saying, "Whoa, you mean my land can be taken away from me like this?"
Right.
And so there was this conflict on point of view, where out of it came, all right, we did a trial and it worked out fine. But the thing that was curious was whether Linden Labs would actually be interested in whether it's a possible way of thinking about governance that users would develop governance systems within. So, all right, we're Harvard Law School, we're teaching a class, we're learning how to do trials, we set up a dispute resolution mechanism. From Linden's point of view, it was clear this company is growing hand over fist. They have not got time for any kind of sophisticated dispute resolution. They see some guy screwing around, whap.
Right.
On the other hand, Linden would be delighted if, I think, if the, a user-developed, user-approved dispute resolution system were somehow to develop within Second Life. So I guess the question is whether your user creativity can extend beyond the creation of buildings and
yes.
to legal models.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. In fact, when I talked about constitutionalization of IP rights, this is very similar to what you are describing in that it limits through the economics of virtual worlds what Linden Lab can do. Linden could kick that guy out, but if it starts kicking tens or hundreds of people out, it has a huge PR problem at its hands. And so how it exercises its right to kick people out is really constrained by its economic or its sort of economic position in the market. And that constrains its governance powers. But that doesn't constrain what the users can do in the space. And so what you see already is that in islands in Second Life that are run by companies or by individuals, you see the equivalent of gated communities. That is, you join this sort of island community, you rent the really nice apartment there, but you also subject yourself to a special subset of rules, or superset, I should say, of rules, of that gated community and that island, on top of the EULAR and the Terms of Services of Linden Lab. And then, of course, you know, you have sort of regulatory competition among these gated communities within Second Life, which is quite interesting as well. What it doesn't reach to, unfortunately, is, or fortunately, is the large swaths of land, the mainland in Second Life, where nobody except Linden Lab has control over whether or not somebody can enter it. Or, and there you'll, I'm sure you'll see institutions coming up. What is interesting, what was interesting to me was a year ago I asked Corey last June, and I said, you know, what legal institutions or societal institutions have been cropping up? And he said only two. One was a dispute resolution company. It was doing okay, but not particularly well. And the other one was a notary public. And the notary public was just for sort of evidentiary purposes on a contract, basically a digital signature service of sorts, an authentication service. And I was shocked. And so I thought, wow, that's a real entrepreneurial opening. So yeah, I think you're right on.
Well, we weren't so interested in entrepreneurially. We were actually interested
in the governance issue.
Yeah, can you create a dispute resolution system? Can you make a trial work? Can you actually come up with some way of doing it? And it's beginning to look like, yeah, I think you could.
Yes, and I think you can. I think you can make it in a way so that even if Linden Lab is not working with you to enforce it, you can still make it relatively enforceable.
We had something similar to what you're talking with the gated communities. Berkman Island is open, but we get griefers coming and doing stuff. And we've now established a policing system where there are, you have the power to exclude somebody from an island,
right,
as you say.
Right.
But to have the administrator of the island burdened with excluding people is no good.
Right.
So we've now established actually a law on Berkman Island with people who have the capacity to enforce the law.
Right.
So it's like we've got the Berkman police now at
right.
work.
Right.
It's a
police state. Oh my God.
What's the police state already?
What's the police law?
It's a little hard to imagine, Charlie, that you're into a police force.
This is my daughter Rebecca. Generation,
right. She's 11.
My daughter.
I have a question about this. Suppose a dispute resolution was set up as the way, suppose you began to have this user-made legal system, and suppose I got into it, and at the end of the trial, I didn't like the outcome. Then what do I do? I mean, doesn't this then just go back to the user agreement?
It seems like a hall of mirrors.
Not really. I mean, you have to differentiate. That's the question of enforcement, right? You have to differentiate. In the private islands that Charlie is talking about, you can actually throw people out of the private island. So you have a very effective user enforcement mechanism, at least from your perspective. Now, what about the mainland, though? What can we do with the mainland? Well, you can actually make, you know, even if you cannot throw somebody off the mainland, you can make the other person's life pretty miserable. But through social protest, continuous social protest, right? Have lots of police bots walk up and down that person with huge signs and saying, this is a liar, or this is a tortfeasor, you know, these kind of things. You can do things.
It's called mob rule, right?
Well, this is civic demos. Civic society.
No, because there
masses of people surrounding you saying you're a liar. This is not mob rule.
No, this is not mob rule, because for mob rule, you would not have a procedure beforehand to do that. these are not actual people who are doing it. These are your bots that are doing it. And they're only doing it after you've gone through, after your dispute resolution system has gone through the process of establishing the facts and then also subjecting it to the rules.
I mean, but what you are describing here is basically, if the analogy holds, then this is the equivalent of civic society. This is the same as I'm kicking you out of my bowling league because, you know, whatever. And right. So, and we have the equivalents in other virtual worlds. You have guilds and you have basically the equivalents. And so you said before that the prerequisite for some kind of governmental hook would be, does that provide a sufficiently robust avenue or entry point for, I mean, would you get government be able to deal with Berkman Island sufficiently? Do you still need some kind of other mechanism to hook between Berkman Island self-governance and some more objective outsider actual governance? Hmm.
I mean, I think there's two questions there. One is sort of, do you need a superstructure? The other one is it forced exit? Is that the only mechanism that counts? Or can you think of other mechanisms sort of less draconian than forced exit that might be implementable as well? But we see that what is interesting to me is in a way you don't have guilds cropping up in Second Life, but you have groups cropping up in Second Life, or clubs are cropping up in Second Life, and they have a relatively similar function.
But you, as you get companies investing real money, and IBM has put like $10 million in, and Adidas, I think, has sold 30,000 shoes.
Cisco and Sun,
and there are all sorts of major plans, and I think, then you have the issue of maybe of real losses, and I know, for example, Nike is creating a concern about people being able to say create their own shoes and then put Kobe on it. Well, Kobe, you know, is a trademark. You can't steal Kobe, but that might be their name. There are all sorts of sort of, or someone starts to steal design from some other party, and so you have this whole enforcement, sort of this blending of what happens in a virtual world versus the real physical world consequences, and then a jurisdiction issue I would think would come up. And then again, I think you do come back to currency questions about being able to, if you can issue your own currencies and you can inflate it, then what, under what accountability are you? I mean, and these start to be real dollars. I mean, in companies, and I think you're going to start to see in the next couple of years, and Cisco is very ambitious about doing things, that people are going to go in and out of these virtual worlds, and they're going to make real transactions and real dollars, significant dollars, that are going to start to be invested in it.
Right.
So you can't sort of, you know, well, we could have protests. I mean, they're going to look for some kind of consistent regimes that sync up with real world.
Maybe, real world. John. Maybe. I'm not so sure. I mean, again, the focus of my talk was not in-world governance. The focus of my talk was regulatory dynamics between virtual worlds and virtual world providers. So if I take it from that perspective, you know, take the example of Dubai again. Okay, all the Saudis, all the Iranians, and all the Iraqis and Kuwaitis who can buy up real estate in Dubai because that's a sort of an island of stability in a relatively rough area of the world. So if they do this, they go in there, they buy United Arab Dirhams, and then with the Arab Dirhams, they buy real estate, right? And some of them invest in real estate funds in Dubai and so forth. This is a very similar bet. It's a bet on the stability of a currency, and it's on the stability of a society. That has huge risks attached to it. Risks that are not so dissimilar to the risks of investing in Second Life. IBM goes in there, invests $10 million, Second Life blows up, IBM has lost $10 million. That's bad for IBM, but guess what? It's not going to break them.
But if it's $1 billion, and if it's very significant, then they may take it to the courts. I mean, you're going to push it outside.
Right. But see, that's the point that I wanted to make, or I wanted to drive. It's not the IBMs that I think will push the internal governance, the cropping up of internal governance. It's people like you and me. because for us, being cheated of $100 or $1,000 is already enough of a grievance for us to really sort of scream for some governance structure, rather than IBM, who is sort of doing...
I think it's naive. I think if it really starts to become really significant, then you're going to have legislation, you're going to have pressures, and you're going to have lobbies, and you're going to have attempts to control it in some way. And they're real dollars, and so it's nice to have a sort of a bottom-up aspect. You may have bottom-up worlds, but I don't think that is going to be the only world.
But I think you're okay. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, I have a question. That's a little. Could you build out a bit what it means to have intellectual property rights in Second Life?
Sure.
Are these copyright, patent, or trademark rights?
Copyright, basically.
And what is being copyrighted? And
whatever you produce is being copyrighted, like real copyright. So the terms of service in the EULA does not include a clause like other virtual world providers have that says whatever you produce is ours. In fact, the clause is whatever you produce is yours.
So can we do an example of somebody who owns a copyright and then has an issue around it?
Sure. I have produced a house... in Second Life, somebody comes along, if I haven't done it right, and sort of steals my house, copies my house. Okay, has another house like that.
Uh-huh. And then I...
And then I think this is a copyright violation because it is under the Copyright Act, basically a copying that has not been, that's not licensed or is not...
Yeah.
So then...
So what makes this a virtual world? It sounds like the real world to me.
My point.
Yeah. That is, I've made a piece of intellectual property.
Right.
I own
right.
it.
Exactly.
I have rights at law.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. But the problem is that this is a virtual. This is a space there that we cannot. That it's hard to map onto a national jurisdiction, right? So you can say, what is the actual national jurisdiction that we're in? Okay, we say, oh, okay, this is easy because this is Linden Labs' domicile. Okay. Well, true, but what if an Iranian contracts with an Australian in Second Life? Okay, what kind of law governs that kind of transaction? You can say, oh, but wait a minute, you law terms
but this
of service.
Again, this again
all...
is also true in the real world.
Yes, although keep in mind that we, since the rise of the nation state, our legal structures have tried very hard to limit the permeability to usually high-value, low-volume transactions. The supertankers driving, you know, sort of shipping oil from A to B, but not the 50-cent transaction across.
So you're saying the background problem here is that the internet doesn't map onto the nation state, which is how IP law is set up.
Doesn't map onto the nation state. There, A to B, there is no physical good that that is being sent from A to B, unlike Amazon.com. It's not only just like iTunes where there's digital goods being transferred, but it's also you are immersed in this world. And so you have a sense of presence, regardless of what the law says. You know, perception is more important there than reality.
I guess my last question, so has there been a case of copyright infringement?
Oh, yeah.
And...
Oh yeah, there have been numerous sort of issues cropping up including trademark issues, design issues, some couturist, some clothes designer sort of designing a beautiful cloth and somebody else coming and say, oh, I kind of steal that idea. There has been the...
But are these cases that have made it to court?
No, not to my knowledge. But you know...
Because that's where the rhetoric hits the road.
we're flat, right?
Maybe, again, maybe not. Maybe we don't see much like that. Maybe what we see is new mechanisms cropping up within these worlds that take care of these type of problems. Cheaper with lower transaction cost than you will see in the real world. This is what we already see, you know, outside of virtual worlds. When you look at cases like SquareTrade.com.
Yes,
where SquareTrade.com in the last couple of years resolved 6 million disputes for a fraction of the cost. No. Why?
Not all of them. I mean, there was a big percentage they didn't. I mean, they had to have a lot of tried in court. There's a certain percentage
right.
SquareTrade could deal. Then
but,
you
but Square, Square Trade's actual success rate is way over 90%. The fact is that, you know, what there remains, there's still hundreds, if not thousands, of cases that they haven't resolved. No question about that. But, you know, with six million...
I think there's certain classes I think that are great. I mean, yeah. I think the new kind of digital institutions can be created here. But you're going to have the inevitable interface at some point that you're going to have to deal with. I mean, I don't see how that could be.
Maybe, but that was not the topic of my talk. I'm just sort of venturing out of my comfort zone here. Any more questions? And I think one more, and we should wrap it up, John.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
let's get both of them, and then let me answer it together.
Well, my question is just in terms of the Second Life terms of use. Do you have any sense of whether the big players, the corporate players in Second Life, negotiated those and got customized terms of use? The reason I ask is because we had someone like the Berkman Center come to us in the clinical program here and say, we want to go into Second Life and do like a Berkman Island type thing, but the general counsel of our institution doesn't want to let us do that because the terms of use have, basically it was an issue around IP where you own everything, but Linden Lab has a pretty broad license to use that. They actually changed that in the most recent, is the most recent version that I've seen of the terms of use, in that now there's an opt-out system where they can use it, but if you tell them you can't use this for promotional purposes, you can't use IBM, you know, and Linden Labs materials, then, you know, Linden Labs will not do that. Mm-hmm. But I was just curious whether, you know, the IBMs of the world are actually, whether there's a different set of rules applicable to the big commercial players than to the standard users who don't have the leverage to negotiate the terms of use.
My understanding is, I do not know. And so, to my knowledge, there aren't special deals and agreements. But has the pressure of the business world made a dent on how Linden Lab phrases and frames its terms of service? You bet.
Less a question than a couple of observations. The first is that the web, as it was conceived in the first place with the domain name system, which we describe in the language of real estate. We have addresses with locations. We build them. We architect them. They are domains that we own. That's the way it was set up in the first place. We have traffic and visitors, right? It's a profoundly private place. We talk about the web as a public space, but it's not. It's private in an abundant way, okay? And some of them have grown enormously, like Linden Labs created one, Google's created one, and we start conflating that with the web itself. You know, we have these big private areas that are like big bubbles in the middle of all these little private spaces, and think of that as a public space. It's still profoundly private. That's the first thing. The second thing is that this last week we had an experience that two of us, David Weinberger, myself, and our co-author Chris Locke of the ClueTrain Manifesto, were involved in one of the biggest controversies in a long time, and the behavior of people in the course of that has been really interesting, because there's this tendency we have, especially with blogs, to behave as if in fact there were no public domain at all, to sort of get in our pulpits and yell at each other in the complete absence of any evidence. It was a really interesting thing, and I don't want to, it's a kind of a rat hole, but the interesting thing about it, a woman named Kathy Sierra declined to go to an event and said that she had death threats and she named names, and Chris Locke was one of them. I was another one. And basically a trial by opinion was held, and it was utterly inconclusive. Mm-hmm. And in which not a single bit of evidence was presented. Mm-hmm. That was hard. Mm-hmm. That was interesting to me, because I feel like we don't have a public domain. Mm-hmm. We don't have what we would call a commons. Mm-hmm. There is not, on the web, between these private spaces, it is easier for somebody to blog an accusation than to call somebody on the phone and say, what's the facts here? That didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, the public virtual world is one we sort of have, but it's really weird, and I don't know what to make of it yet. And and even beginning to approach the notion of governance external to any private space. I mean, I've arrived at a big respect for the private spaces like Linden Labs has, because there is at least a private god to kick the bad guys out, or to say, well, you guys work this out, or whatever. There isn't out here. It's kind of interesting that way. So,
I mean it with all due respect and with the sort of great deference. You sound like Habermas. sound like Habermas in that you want to sort of, you long for this ideal of a public sphere, a civilized public sphere.
Yeah.
And Habermas kind of has located it in history in the coffee houses of pre-revolutionary France.
Mm-hmm.
And of course...
That went so well, didn't
it? Yeah. civic virtue in the civil society organizations of revolutionary France that chopped off all the heads. but what is interesting is that so Habermas has this longing, very very similar longing, for civic discourse. Now, of course, historians, you know, Habermas is a sociologist. This was his famous tenure piece, 1962, just got published a few years back in an English translation by MIT Press, which I highly recommend. It's a great read. But when you read it, and then you read the critique that has been mounted on it, you find out there weren't any of these coffee houses in revolutionary France. It's basically a made-up story, in a way.
Wow.
It's sort of like, it is a narrative that doesn't hold water. And so we have this longing of civility,
yes,
but perhaps there isn't a lot of civility anywhere. and we have to sort of suck it up.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
Which is really sad, because I'd sympathize with you. I'm all there.
It's a lesson. I don't know what it is.
Let me push one final thought. You haven't pushed me on one issue that I was hoping to come, that it would come up. So now I have to sort of make it anyway. Shove it in. Have you noticed that a couple of weeks back, maybe a month or a month and a half back, Linden Lab declared that its client would be open sourced, or has been open sourced.
Yeah.
Now, I wonder, I have no inside knowledge about this, okay? I'm wondering if the client is open sourced, okay? What does Linden Lab still have? It has the infrastructure and it has the copyright on the server version. What would happen if Linden Lab open sources the server version? Okay, and also makes it available to others. Okay. Then we have the ability of other companies to create virtual worlds, right? That sort of are basically interoperable. Here we are,
that's right, with
Second Life,
right.
Completely interoperable, but are run by different companies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and guess what? Who would then be in the position to run such a virtual world very well? You know, those that have lots of servers and huge bandwidth and can operate it quite well.
What?
Now, you're thinking about the Google and all that. So there is some real synergy there. There are some real business opportunities there. And we could see a proliferation of virtual world providers that have interoperabilities. You can not just teleport from one island to the other, but teleport from one world to another world.
Take all your stuff with it and materialize it.
That can have very different rule sets and sort of sub-rule sets and all that. And we could imagine all kinds of versions of that. We could also imagine a Linden Lab Europe having a different setup than a Linden Lab US and all that.
It's a great idea.
That, I think, is where it's going.
Yeah, that's
where it's going.
Well,
that's great.
I had a question in my mind that I was way too shy to ask because I don't know anybody here. But actually, what I was thinking is if it developed into something more peer-to-peer is what I was thinking of.
Exactly.
Of not companies, but individuals have servers in their house.
Yes.
And they're just all over the place, and you hop from one to one. Then there would be no company.
Now, each server would also need a Linden exchange of sorts, right? Because you need to have some money flow and so forth. Except, if you could change the code base so that you could have an outside institution who would run the money for you. And I'm thinking of a kind of PayPal.
You're going to exchange it. That's happening.
That's right.
That's happening. I mean,
so in that sense, we are moving towards, I think, a much more multifaceted landscape in this particular domain than we have currently.
Very good. Well, thank you very much.